Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for F This Movie by...
Hello, Governor!
It's Doug, back from London, everyone.
Pip, pip, cheerio!
He has really changed.
Bangers and mash!
If that gets annoying, everyone, I'm sorry, but this is who Doug is now.
And Bob's your uncle!
This is who he is.
Is it better than this? Patrick, please, call me Doug. From London.
It turns out that some people did not realize that was an impression of the Beast.
Really?
Well, nobody has seen that movie, it turns out, based on the comments and the emails.
Right.
But even JB said, like, it wasn't until about 15 minutes into the show that he realized, like, oh, Doug's doing the impression.
He just really thought I was doing, like, an annoying
voice. Yeah, I don't know.
That'll be my thing from now on. I'll just do weird voices. Hey, everybody, it's Doug!
Doug was in London, but he's home now.
I am. I saw so much in London. I saw Buckingham Friars. I don't know what it's called. Bryanham Palace? Is that something?
I don't think you went to London at all. I think you had a staycation.
Westchester Rubies. I saw the Leaning Ben's Towers. I saw the Tower of the Leanings. I saw Pocodonte Circus. I saw where all the Bortles played, that rock group from the 60s, the Bortles. I saw Arby Road. I saw lots of things, is what I'm saying. I went to London. The proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is in my passport, travel very hard. There's pudding in my passport.
Let me clarify something, okay?
Yes.
You've seen London. You've seen France.
Oh, I see where you're going here.
Yeah.
No. To answer all the questions, no, I am not wearing... Wait, is that what you're going for?
Something about underpants.
I'm wearing pudding underpants.
Pudding pants.
Pudding pants. Anyway, I just
came back. I'm joined tonight by old pudding pants, Doug.
Hey, Patrick!
Hey, pudding pants!
Hey, I heard you like movies. You know what I like?
What's that, pudding pants?
Pudding.
I gotta give all the information, like, about how you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com, which, by the way, if you only listen to our podcast, thank you, that's awesome, and we really appreciate it, but you owe it to yourself to check out fthismovie.blogspot.com, because we've been adding a lot of stuff.
What does that even mean, you owe it to yourself? Owe
I just
it.
Feel like...
No, I know what it means, but what does it mean? Where does it come from?
I think people do.
People should owe themselves something.
You should check it out, because there's stuff on there that I think is worth reading. We're not just a podcast, is what I'm saying.
And, you know, at one point, I think we used to be more of a podcast with an occasional, but now I think we have content every day of the gosh darn week. So.
Just about. The work week, at least. Sometimes we take the weekends
Everybody's working for
By the way,
weekends.
Doug now says weekend, and I'm like, oh, that's so British.
I say sport also, but that's not British.
No, that's just Mitt Romney.
Douchey pudding.
You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. You can email us always at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And you can find us in the iTunes store. And if you listen to us in iTunes, or not in iTunes, and you like what you hear, please go in iTunes and give us a nice rating.
Yes, rate us. Like, rate my face.
Yeah.
Like, hot or not.
Oh, definitely hot. But again, if you want to hear all of our shows, going all the way back to Avatar, show number one, you have to go to fthismovie.blogspot.com.
So what is this, show number 104?
I lost track now that we're past 100, but that sounds right. I think it's 104.
Wow.
And iTunes starts bumping them after 100. So you have to go to fthismovie.blogspot.com to hear all of our old shows.
Absolutely.
And who doesn't want to hear our Young Guns show?
I want to hear lots of shows from the past. Anchorman.
Yeah.
I want to hear...
That's in there. That's in the beginnings.
Signs.
That's early.
I'm just naming early stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to hear Cabin Fever.
That's there also.
Shows that definitely exist. And that's all I'll say about
that. Tonight we're talking about The Iron Giant.
That's right. Starring Robert Downey Jr.
Yes.
And Scarlett Johansson.
Wait.
And...
Wait.
Mamie Van Doren.
I watched a movie with Billy Crystal. I watched My Giant.
But that movie was funny.
It was.
Just like his monologue on the Oscars. I want to say, I was not, as Patrick pointed out, I was in Pudding, Europe, which is the capital of London. And I missed out on the Oscars. I was effing the BAFTAs hard, right in their BAFTA face. And I missed the Oscars because they started at 1 o'clock in the morning, where I was, and I'm like, I'm too sleepy after seeing all the sights with my eyes.
Yeah.
And
I've got tube lag.
I thought the tweets were hilarious. I thought they were really funny. The show looked like it was the worst thing I think I'd ever seen.
I think it managed to be worse than even the James Franco show.
I saw yesterday, I tuned into some website and checked out Billy Crystal's, first the opening film.
Yeah.
Which there's nothing funny about that. No. It is embarrassingly bad. And especially having it removed a week for me, at least, not having the excitement. And I think there is a genuine excitement to watching the Oscars, especially with your friends. You're kind of caught up in it a little bit, at least.
Nope.
But you're watching it like at work on a small screen. It's like everything is a giant pimple. It looks horrible. And then his monologue, that is, there's no jokes.
No.
He just names the movie and smirks. And
then, yeah. But he sang a song, and the titles of the movies were in the song.
Did you see
Remember?
Seth Rogen's
I read some of the jokes.
Monologue.
I didn't watch.
Oh, my. He was, I mean, he's hilarious.
Yeah,
and obviously,
he's very funny.
I think it was the Independent Spirit Awards. Yeah. It lends itself to that. You know, he was very rated R and lots of swears and stuff. But it was, I mean, it was so freaking funny.
Yeah.
And then you compare the two, and it's like, wow, this is so.
You know what, though? Billy Crystal can be funny without swearing.
Yeah. He could be more friendly with Botox, I think, because that man's had a lot of plastic
surgery.
He's
weird looking, for
sure. He is absolutely weird looking.
We're not talking about the Oscars. Those are a week old.
I know, and you probably talked about it earlier. I'm just telling you right now that we haven't talked. I just got back from London,
yes,
where I saw
back.
Havisham burn.
I know you were in London, so obviously you have an excuse, but did you have a chance to see anything good lately?
Good, no.
Have you seen anything?
I have seen
any
a couple
movies
things
lately.
I saw one thing on the way back from Londinium, which is the Roman word for London, because it was a Roman little settlement. That's going to be full of London facts.
I
this
like
whole
it.
Podcast,
I like
this
it.
Whole pudding cast. On the way back, we flew a 767, which has TVs in the headrests, which are a horrible way to watch movies because it's a 4-inch or 5-inch screen. And the guy in front of me reclined, so I'm watching it from like a top angle. I'm looking down, and it was kind of cool because they were replaying, it's a, I think, 8-hour flight home, so they had 6 channels playing movies, and they would just start over and over, so you can theoretically watch a few, but the options were J. Edgar,
okay,
which I wouldn't touch, The Artist, which I still haven't seen, and I want to see on a better screen, even though I don't think it really merits a better screen, because it just looks like a gimmicky,
else,
novelty, garbage movie.
You have to be able to read, and
right.
That might be hard to do, honestly, on a screen that small.
The Muppets, which I was going to see also, but I also figured I could see it, you know, soon when it comes out on HBO or something.
Yeah.
I forgot the Tintin, and the one I did see was Tower Heist. And it's a perfect airplane movie because you can check out and come back in and know exactly where things are.
Right.
That movie, I think you reviewed it, didn't you?
I did, for my other job.
Right. It's there's elements that are fine that you kind of like, and you know it's exciting to see Eddie Murphy act again. Mm-hmm. But I don't really even care. I don't even subscribe to like where's he been
because
he has been he's been Pluto. He's been on Pluto. Pluto Nash.
He's been meeting Dave.
He's been meeting. And I just the end. I'm just going to talk about the end for spoilers.
Spoilers
for
coming
Tower
up
Heist.
For Tower Heist, everyone.
So the Bernie
Skip
Madoff
ahead.
Character, Alan Alda plays, steals people's monies because he's an investor in hedge funds and stuff. And all of the money he steals, he puts into gold, and he makes a gold Ferrari. Stop right there. The whole thing is fucking ridiculous. So they have to steal the gold Ferrari from his penthouse in Manhattan. And who even effing cares how they do it? Because the whole thing is just stupid. I mean, you're watching, this is stupid. I feel dumber for watching this. But the end of the movie, when Ben Stiller, spoiler, goes to jail.
Jeez.
And,
you're really spoiling
Yeah,
Tower
fuck
Heist.
This movie. I hate this movie. I actually don't until I start talking. Like, I didn't think I hated this movie. And then I'm talking to you right now, and you... You know your name. And I find myself not loving it. But the end of the movie, so everyone, all the workers he's bilked, get pieces of gold car.
Yeah.
And they're all so excited. Like, my retirement is in this carburetor that's made of pure gold. It is the dumbest fucking... Every story's been done. Except the gold car story. Is that what...
I guess,
I'm talking
kind
of loud right now. I apologize.
No, it's all right.
I'm maxing out the thing.
It's okay.
Yeah,
anyway,
I saw Tower Heist.
I did not hate Tower Heist. I mean, I liked the first half, kind of. I feel like the movie kind of blows it when it gets to the heist. Because we've just seen such better heist movies. I mean, obviously the most recent example would be Ocean's 11, which is a great heist and shows you things and keeps you interested and then kind of pulls back and says, okay, but what you were seeing wasn't even what you were actually seeing. You know what I mean? Where it kind of plays tricks on you, but in like a fun way.
Yeah.
And Tower Heist does it. Tower Heist is so straightforward. It's like, we're going to do this. And then they do this.
There's one kind of misdirect with Eddie Murphy.
Which is terrible.
It's a horrible thing.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
But part of his misdirect is he locks up one of the guys who might pinch them. And it's like, well, why wasn't that part of their plan to begin with?
Right.
Whatever. A Tower Heist, go to Europe and watch it on a plane back and cross your fingers that that plane doesn't crash. Because that's how that movie made me feel.
Anything else besides Tower Heist?
Well, I was so high from London
that
I wanted to kind of remember it. So I watched the most London movie I could think of, and it's on Netflix Instant.
All right.
And it was Notting Hill.
Oh, yes.
Which, it came out in 99.
Yeah.
It feels
same,
like...
Same year as Iron Giant. Same summer.
It feels like it came out in 92. Everything about it feels just... I can't believe... I haven't seen a movie, and granted, I don't know if there's a lot of romantic comedies in that vein that have come out recently that aren't like Dear John or Nicholas Sparks type movies. I feel like I haven't seen a movie like that in such a long time. And there's parts of it that are incredibly charming because Hugh Grant does a tap dance the entire movie. By the way, Julia Roberts as the movie star, there's nothing about, aside from her beauty, which granted, she's attractive. I know some people out there don't like the way she looks, but I think she's got this
radiant. I actually don't think she looks great in that movie, which is such a stupid, like, shallow thing to say.
Right, you're pretty
shallow. When you're putting her up as, like, the most beautiful movie star in the world, I just thought, like, maybe her hair and makeup people did a disservice in that movie.
In one of the most famous scenes, she's wearing, like, this weird blue dress with, like, a lighter blue sweater and flip-flops. And normally I don't even pay attention to that stuff, except when she walks out of the...
You just hear like flip-flops.
Yeah, flip, for real. You're noticing she's like having like... Because when you wear flip-flops, you walk kind of stilted.
I don't wear flip-flops, but I know what you're talking about.
Patrick only wears Birkenstocks, sorry.
I'm a sandal man. What do you want?
Sandal man?
Yeah. Sandal man and pudding pants. We're a morning DJ team. Hey, everybody, listen to Sandal Man. I'm here with pudding pants.
The movie...
With the weather.
Hugh Grant is obviously charming. You have a great impression of Hugh Grant. Please share your...
I just stutter. I can't.
Terribly sorry. Terribly sorry. He just apologizes for existing, basically. And aside from Julia Roberts' beauty, there's nothing endearing about her. So he is like doing this song and dance for her, and she basically like permits him to date her, and then she fucks him over or like is pissed off at something, and then she kind of opens up to him, but she doesn't like earn... him coming back to her.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, yeah, the movie never quite makes a case for why he's in love with her.
Yeah.
Except that she's super famous.
Right, and she is, and again, I will say that she can turn on this charm where she smiles, and I was telling this to my wife, and it's a beautiful smile, and I don't care if people...
Money in the bank,
but
they
call
that.
But then she amps up her smile sometimes, too. That's like, it's pretty incredible. Yeah. I think that her smile range is all over the place. And the last thing I'll say about Notting Hill, because I'm realizing we're already 13 minutes in, and I'm fucking talking about Notting Hill, is that the one line of dialogue where she, you know, it's the famous line from Notting Hill where she goes, I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love her. My memory is that it's very ham-fisted. It's very on the nose and kind of like obnoxiously so, where it's like, oh my God, this is the Cameron Crowe-esque overwritten line of dialogue that will be in all the trailers. And it was, except her performance, her delivery of it is actually not so bad. And I was like, well, I'm pleasantly surprised that that came across not as trite and whatever with, you know, 12 years distance or 13 years distance. And then in the very next scene, Hugh Grant is talking to all of his wacky friends, including his sister with the crazy hair and their wonderful British accents, which I got so sick of after a week. And he verbatim, word for word, repeats the little dialogue that she did to him. And I'm thinking, like, what? Why are you forcing this down our throats? Just let it exist on its own and we'll gravitate towards it because it's a great line.
And for the record, I mean, that's a bad scene in any movie. Not just that he's repeating a line that he shouldn't, that they should have left alone to have its little power in its moment. But what movie do you want to see a scene where a guy recaps the scene from 10 seconds ago? Like, it's a movie. You can just cut that part out. We understand that he caught his friends up to speed.
All that being said, actually, I still think Notting Hill has a lot of charm.
Yeah,
it's still a pretty endearing movie, even though it's dated and kind of feels...
Well, again, it's kind of a romantic comedy that's not pitched at, like, 15-year-olds, which is where so many of them are pitched at now.
Nicholas Sparks crap, right?
Right, it's kind of pitched more at adults, which is nice, you know?
So, Patrick, what have you seen lately?
Well, what haven't I seen? Because...
Well, you haven't seen Notting Hill lately.
Good point. I'm not going to bore you with the probably 20 different... terrible direct-to-DVD action movies that I've watched because I'm on this crazy kick. Let me ask you a question, though.
Me or the audience?
You.
Because they probably
you're
can't answer
the, yeah, no, you're in the room with me, and you're the literally the best I can do right now.
You know what? Thank you.
Like, when... I know this happens to you. This happens to a lot of us obsessive types, especially like who love movies. Like, you get on a kick, right?
Oh, yeah.
Is it better to like try and space it out so the kick lasts longer? Or do you try and absorb as much as you can during the window that it's still holding your interest?
I think
is it better to see 50 movies inside of a week so that you know now you've seen those 50 movies? Or do you try and stretch it out a little bit?
I think stretching out is the practical, pragmatic thing to do. Like, you say to yourself, you know what? I love Jean-Claude Van Damme or Steven Seagal movies, and I'm on this kick right now where I want to see them all. But I'll wait, and I'll stretch it out and make it make the buzz last.
Right.
It never works. It never pans out. I think that eventually...
Because you still lose interest, right?
You lose interest, and life gets
in
the way.
And then you haven't seen those
movies.
Right,
and all of a sudden you're realizing, oh, it's been a week since I even turned the DVD player on for that kind of thing, and I've got to go to this appointment or whatever. You got to see them all.
All right,
like, no, I'm serious. You got to see them all, like... right away, back to back, because that's the way to really enjoy it. And then if you get sick of it, you have more of a legitimate reason to be like, I am burnt out on that.
Yeah.
I went through a summer where I read only Laura Ingalls Wilder's books. That's a true story,
haven't
by
touched
the way.
One since.
I have not. Yeah. You're correct.
And you also stopped churning your own butter.
This summer,
but
20,
not masturbating.
2011.
Which is the euphemism that I use for churning butter. I call that masturbating.
Just masturbating some milk.
So I'm not going to talk about the action movies because I've been writing this column on the website, fthismovie.blogspot.com, and I don't want to give away what I would say. I don't even know what I'm going to say yet. I will talk about one of those, but in just a second. I watched a movie called Like Crazy, which I reviewed over at DVD Verdict, dvdverdict.com.
Thank you, Michael Saley.
Yes. It was not good, and it was a movie that, like, came out of, I think, Sundance with a lot of buzz. People were really loving that movie, and I cannot for the life of me
figure out. What's it about? It's a romantic comedy?
It's a romance. It's not a comedy. It's a drama. It's about a guy and a
girl.
Is the
name, like Crazy?
Who meet in college and fall in love very fast and decide they want to spend the rest of their lives together, but she basically gets... deported. I mean, not exactly. She overstays her student visa and then can't come back to the United States. And
does
he wants to stay here. Yes. Because he's running.
Can I stay in US of A?
She's from London. Oh. Your home.
Yes.
City.
I love it.
He makes furniture, and Alex Lawson had a great joke on Facebook about how, like, yeah, because you can't just move to London to make chairs. He refuses to give up his chair-making business. So it's about them trying to make it work across two continents. And it's just filled with drama and nonsense.
Oh, Like Crazy. Yeah. That's a perfect title for this thing you're describing.
It's not... I just didn't like really any of it. And I could not for the life of me figure out... what the buzz was coming out of Sundance. Because I feel like when the movie actually came out, it sank very quickly, and most of the reviews were pretty negative. So was it just this weird festival high that, but it's not even particularly, like, arty in that way that, like, 500 Days of Summer uses all those crazy film school tricks. Like, it does that maybe twice.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's just, like, handheld nonsense. Anyway, I also watched a movie on Netflix Instant called OSS 117... Cairo, Nest of Spies. And that is the first movie directed by, I'm going to fuck up his name too.
Steven Spielberg.
Michelle Havanavicius?
Jerry Dark? Says, sure.
Who just won the Oscar for The Artist. It also stars the two actors from The Artist, Jean Dujardin and Beatrice Bejo, I think is her name.
Let me try his name. Yeah. Jean Dujardinier.
And it's basically like a spy movie parody. Right. It's like Austin Powers, but
it's a wacky
French.
Right. I've seen parts of it, actually. Part of my job, actually, we were showing that because there's a French contingent for my job.
I remember that. That's what you guys showed?
Yeah, they
That's
showed
fascinating.
This. Where I work, there was a thing where they were showing this, and the local film critic from the Daily Herald came out and introduced it, and there was like a big deal. And
I remember that, but I had no frame of reference.
I think Music Box Films, they have Music Box Theater has a distribution thing called Music Box Films, and they own the rights to that movie.
Wow.
So they were able to get it to us and whatever, and yeah, people were going crazy. It's like a wacky spoof.
Yeah, and that's the
Does
thing.
It work?
It's like, parts of it. I mean, there's a sequel, too. I haven't watched the sequel. They're both available on Netflix Instant. you know, it's like, it's so tired. Like, the James Bond movies, even in the 60s, were verging on self-parody. So, to... There have been so many parodies from, like, in, like, Flint to the Pink Panther movies to fucking Austin Powers. Right. Like, it's just been done so many times.
I thought Krishmish only came once a year.
And this...
Said by Sean Connery. Yeah, yeah.
No, that's why that joke is funny. There would be, like, a really kind of inspired joke, and then just 15 minutes of, like, okay, nothing. It's just, like, it's, going through motions. It's so obvious, and it's so slapsticky. I was like, wow, this guy just won Best Director? It would be like if Jerry Zucker was given Best Director for, like, the movie he made after Airplane, you know? Just, like, that's what this movie basically is.
Airplane 2.
It's interesting only in the sense that, like, A, he really gets the look of the movie right. I mean, even the color timing. It looks exactly like a movie that came out in, like, 1959. And so then I started to think, like, oh, so this is what this guy does? He just approximates an old style of movie? Like, because right. That's all he's doing with the artist, too. And we're all falling all over him for, like, look at how well you approximated a silent movie. Well, that's what he did with OSS 117, right? But also because there are some jokes that I guess could be considered transgressive, because Jean Dujardin is, like, the obnoxious, you know, if he were an American character, he would be, like, the ugly American.
Yeah.
He just obviously thinks France is best and blah, blah, blah. And there's all these sort of weird, like, anti-Muslim jokes. Not really, but, like, he's ignorant and he doesn't understand, you know.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, I guess coming out when it did, that's sort of transgressive, that it's making Muslim jokes. Again, the jokes are at the expense of the French character, not at the expense of the Muslims, but whatever. I didn't think it was great, and yeah. I know a lot of people really think they're hilarious.
I think people are also, though, that's true, and I think people have always thought that, but I do think that there's a new wave of people that are rediscovering this movie, yeah. And are just on this high from the artist, which, again, I'll say, again, I have not seen, yeah. And again, it looks like, the clips I have seen, I'm like, well, this is a novelty. This is a vacuum commercial, you know?
Yeah, that's like what OSS 117 is, but the artist benefits from, like, not continually going for, like, hacky jokes.
Right.
Which this one does, and so I think the artist will hold up a little bit better. I don't know. Mm. And
well, no, 2012, this is what represents the year.
The actor, cinema. You know, Jean Dujardin, is very good at playing the part of just, like, arrogant. He has this funny, like, face that he does the whole movie. But I don't get it.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So check it out on Netflix Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
Your recommendation.
Last movie I'm going to talk about, and then we'll start talking about The Iron Giant. Again, I'm watching all these crazy action movies. Just the bottom of the barrel, like Steven Seagal direct-to-DVD action movies. But I did finally, for the first time, see a movie from a couple years ago called JCVD, which is Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Nice.
Like an art movie, almost, that he made after, you know, a string of terrible action movies. This, I believe, a French or Belgian filmmaker wrote this movie for him to star, and he plays himself as, like, sort of a washed-up action star. He's fighting for custody of his daughter. He's having money problems. He goes into a bank to wire some money to his lawyer. The bank gets held up. They're like, oh, well, you're Jean-Claude Van Damme. You're a celebrity. They sort of make him a part of the robbery. They make it seem like he's the one robbing the bank. And that's sort of what the movie's about, and it's incredible. It's such a great movie.
Really?
Yeah, it's so great. It's not really an action movie, although there's this one, like, 6-minute...
The way you described it.
...single take action sequence at the beginning of the movie that's so great. He gives this fucking speech, and this is what I remember people talking about when the movie
came
out.
When did this come out?
2008, maybe.
Okay, so it's recent.
And it didn't really play, you know, wide. It might not have even gotten theatrical distribution around us, at least. I remember people talking about this monologue that he does about 2/3 of the way through the movie, and it's fucking unbelievable.
He's a good actor?
It's incredible. He's sitting in the bank. It's this super cool shot where he's, like, basically sitting on a crane, and it raises up like out of a fucking Spike Lee movie, like, above the set.
Okay.
So it's like, haha, you're in a movie, you're reminded, and he just gives this speech directly to the camera about, like, how he fucked up his life, and he starts crying. It's unreal.
Is this on Netflix Instant?
No.
How'd you watch it?
I have it.
You own it, okay.
Yeah.
I might need to borrow that. The way you describe it, it almost seems like a joke, you know, like it's art house little like thing.
And parts of it are. I mean, there's definitely jokes in the movie about sort of his career, about like, there's this ongoing joke about like, well, at least Van Damme, you brought John Woo to the States. And then this other character is like, yeah, but who gives a shit? Did you see
Broken Arrow?
No, what's the Wind Talkers? Like, yeah. Jokes on him.
By the way, I saw Wind Talkers. Joke is on all
yeah,
of us.
Yeah, right. But yeah, check it out if you're a Van Damme fan or if you're just fascinated by the movie I just described.
I am fascinated by the movie you just described, for sure.
I thought it was great. I really, really loved
it.
But
I still haven't seen Old Boy, and you've been pressuring me to see that for about 2 years.
True, true.
But I will. I'll see it. I'll see it soon.
I trust you.
In the other room with you. Right now. Pause.
Let's talk about The Iron Giant from 1999.
Let's talk about The Iron Giant.
I believe this is the first animated film we've devoted an entire episode to.
An entire 30 minutes to. Entire half an episode to. This might be a little... This is interesting because usually we obviously decide on which movie to talk about for the podcast, and then... The day of the podcast, I'll call Patrick or he'll call me and we'll talk about like when we meet and all that stuff. And we oftentimes do talk a little bit about the movie we're going to talk about. And this was the first time, I think, that we have not said anything about this movie. Yeah. And why that's interesting is because I've seen this movie a bunch of times. I saw it in the theater by myself when it first came out.
I remember.
I've seen it a bunch of times, like late at night.
We were at the theater. We were both at the theater that night.
By ourselves?
So you saw Iron Giant.
What'd
you see? Because
you
left a note on my car.
Oh, that's right.
I think I was seeing The Haunting. So you might have come out ahead.
Haunting came out in August or July?
It might have still been playing because I didn't see it, I think, when it first opened.
Okay.
Somehow I got around to it.
Well, yeah, I remember going by myself and I'm like, I really want to see this movie. Yeah. A lot of the commercials spoke to me and I saw it by myself and I was really blown away. I thought it was great. And then I got it on DVD and I've watched it a bunch of times by myself. I watched it recently with my wife. I watched it again for this. And it's great. And Patrick had never seen it. You have never seen
it. I've
had
it on DVD for probably 7 years, and I've just never watched it.
Why I think that's so interesting, and if you've listened to the podcast, you obviously know Patrick's tastes in movies, what drives you, what you find interesting, and a lot of it has to do with sci-fi. You like sci-fi a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You like the 50s a ton. You love invasion movies and horror movies and all these things that this does. In fact, Matinee, one of your favorite movies, does a lot of the same things in this movie.
Yeah.
So what? I have no idea what you thought of the movie. Tell me what you thought of the movie.
It's hard to talk about. I liked it a lot. I mean, you know, but that's basically, that's it. You go.
Okay.
Because it's hard to sort of process a lot of my thoughts because I watched it today for the first time. So I haven't had much time to like live with it and think about it. I haven't seen it more than once, which sometimes helps. I liked it a lot. I was fascinated by a lot of it because this was Brad Bird's first theatrical feature, right? And then he would go on to make The Incredibles and Ratatouille and, of course, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. He's made 4 movies in 13 years. What the hell?
Right. But all of them, I read some statistic that was like, I mean, again, this is all arbitrary crap, but in Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic, he is one of the best reviewed directors. Like, his top 5 best reviewed, all of his stuff is like top rated, you know, because all four of those movies are excellent.
And The Iron Giant is the only one of the four that was sort of a box office bomb in 99. And critics loved it. And I think everybody who sees it or has seen it since loves it, but it didn't make any money.
It absolutely was a big, I think it cost, I read different projections on different websites. I want to say it cost anywhere between $40 and $70 million
to
make.
Crazy.
Which
I
is
don't understand
it's insane to me, right? But I think to myself, well, why would it cost so much money? Because obviously it's all animation and there's no huge set pieces. But I think a lot of it's obviously the actors, and there's some A-list actors on there who probably had a good salary.
Yeah.
And I think Pete Townsend from The Who was a producer, and originally, let me back up. The movie is based on a book called The Iron Man by, I think his name is Ted Hughes.
That sounds right. It was written in the 60s,
right? Yeah, and it's very similar. There's some marked differences, but it's pretty much the same overall thing. And it's always been kind of, the book has always been seen as this property where you can make a musical, you can make a TV show, you can make a movie. It's always been batted around back and forth. And Pete Townsend from The Who, the guitarist, who may or may not be into children,
he's definitely into sleuthing. He's definitely an online sleuth.
That's right. He's a gumshoe. He came across and bought rights and actually wrote a musical for it, I think, before the movie came out. And then originally the movie was supposed to be, and they even talked about doing a live action movie, and eventually it ended up being a cartoon, and they said no music, it's not going to be a cutesy Disney thing with talking animals and stuff. And he got paid anyway.
Right.
And I think that's got to be a huge, you know, $2 million
yeah,
at least.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, the budget does go up in that respect. But, yeah, it made, I want to say, $5.8 million in its original run.
Oh, my gosh.
But then, worldwide, it grossed a lot more.
Okay.
And it gained huge popularity on, I think, Cartoon Network would play it 24 hours a day on, I forget, some holiday. I want to say, like, New Year's Day. Right. I want to say it was New Year's Eve or New Year's Day where they would literally play it from midnight to midnight. And it got a huge cult following, and people have bought it on DVD and stuff. And everyone who, like you said, everyone who has seen it raves about it. They love
it. Right. But it's probably more like people our age and older, right? I don't know. I mean, can kids still get pulled into a traditional, like, cell animated movie? Because I think that's part of the movie's problem is that it came out, you know, Pixar had already sort of started. They did Toys. This came out the same year as Toy Story 2. So Toy Story was already out. Bug's Life was already out. Toy Story 2 was already out. I feel like cell animation was sort of on its way out. It didn't have, like, the Disney push behind it.
Warner Brothers, right.
And they had no idea what to do with it. So it's kind of sad that it died. But, yeah, I thought the movie was great. I liked...
well, especially because I'm sorry to cut you off. But the movie came out, the previous Warner Brothers movie was like a Camelot movie?
Quest for Camelot. Yeah, they had been trying for years to sort of get an animation division going. They had like The Pebble and the Penguin, possibly Cats Don't Dance. I mean, I'm naming some really fucking obscure Warner Brothers animated movies.
When did Titan A.E. come out? Was that after or before? Because that was also Warner Brothers too, wasn't it?
No, that was Fox.
Okay, because that's a piece of shit.
I saw it, and I just do not remember 10 seconds of it.
It's Matt Damon. I think I might have seen it with you.
Yeah, you did. And, that might have come out in like 2000. Okay. But it might have been 99.
Because honestly, at that time, there still was like traditional...
Yeah.
What was the last... I mean, Lilo and Stitch, was that the last one of the last like animated...
Well,
like,
Winnie the Pooh came out last year, but of course nobody saw it.
And even that, so honestly, it almost seems like...
It was a novelty.
A bubble, right?
Right, it was. It was like, look, here's another sort of cell animated
like
movie.
A throwback.
And nobody saw it, so much for that.
And in kind of... And further explanation, even though it's a traditional hand-drawn, this is the first movie where I think they really integrated all CGI with the hand-drawn stuff, too. I read everything with the monster, everything with the giant is CGI.
Which you can't really tell.
No, because they
really
actually had a program that made it look a little wobbly.
Yeah.
Like they had some imperfections, and it wasn't so slick and so smooth, which is insane.
Yeah, that's cool, though. That,
right, but it's Brad Bird's autism.
By the size of... Hogwarts. What's his name?
Hogarth.
Hogarth. I was distracted by his name, Hogarth. Which isn't, you know, Brad Bird can't be blamed for that, or whoever, it's the dude who wrote the book. But his hands are very large.
The kid's hands are?
Yeah.
Oh.
Anyway. It's...
You know they say about kids with big hands, Pete Townsend knows.
like you said, it's definitely sort of this amalgam of all these different things that I like.
Yeah.
And so that all worked on me. I mean, it's E.T. and it's Super 8 and it's Matinee. I mean, it's all these different things sort of going on at once. I definitely liked it. I just felt like for a lot of the movie, while this isn't a complaint, it was like, it was very well done, but I didn't feel like it was anything I hadn't seen a bunch of times. And I'm not necessarily saying that as a criticism that like Iron Giant is derivative, because part of the problem is I'm 13 years late to the party.
Yeah.
So I've had a chance to see Iron Giant called something else a bunch more times, you know,
sure.
Even Transformers like rips off, you know, things from Iron Giant. Just like, I'm a kid. I have this giant robot. I have to keep it a secret.
Right.
You stay in the forest, giant robot, you know, like, had I seen it in 99, it probably would have felt newer. I feel like in the last act, it definitely goes to some new places. And that's the thing that I always like about Brad Bird's movies, with the exception of like Mission Impossible, which I love. But Mission Impossible doesn't really take big chances.
No, it doesn't need to, obviously.
Right.
It's not kind of built in. It's
right.
The Mission Impossible story is established and there's a template to follow. And he does it.
But it's just interesting in his other movies that he's working in this genre, the sort of animated genre, movies that appeal to kids or families, but he always finds ways to work in these, not subversive messages, but I just think messages that are much more adult than most kids' movies
sure.
are willing to put in there. And I don't know that the Iron Giant does a ton of that, but I liked the fact that the Iron Giant was dangerous.
Yeah.
That they didn't just make him this cuddly, misunderstood robot. It's not his fault, but he's still a weapon.
Right. And that's something, right, exactly, that his purpose is to be a weapon.
Right.
And he comes to Earth, I don't know if it's by chance or by accident right. or on purpose, but his purpose is to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there's something that happens along the way, like where he discovers humanity and, you know, finds his soul, that changes him, but he still reacts, obviously. When he sees guns, his eyes, you know,
right.
His pupils narrow and he turns red and
right.
has that reaction to it. But yeah, it does kind of go on these crazy points. And near the end, when he goes full out
yeah.
badass robot,
yeah.
it's equal parts awesome because it's like the boy in me is like, right. holy shit, this is fucking cool.
Right.
But also terrifying because, right. you know, it's just all of a sudden he's unstoppable. He really is like the indestructible robot. They can't right. even... Spoilers for Iron Giant.
Well, yeah. I was just going
to
say...
I don't want to know if we can... Should we spoil
it? Well, yeah. I think we need to. We're 36 minutes in, and if you haven't seen The Iron Giant, you should. Don't make the same mistake I did. It's on Netflix Instant. You should watch it, because there are some things in the end that I think we need to address. So, there are some people who get annoyed when we have to, like, make this big spoiler disclaimer, because they're like, you're talking about old movies. People should have seen it by now. But right. I feel like it's only fair.
Absolutely. Like, and really, have we really wasted that much of your time? You're sitting in your cubicle... fashioning an Excel spreadsheet for a boss who's probably a closet alcoholic, and you're really concerned about the 30 seconds you just wasted with us, please.
So go ahead. Spoilers for Iron Giant
so
coming up.
So, make a long story short, a nuclear missile is launched, and the Iron Giant, recognizing that everyone's going to die, launches himself up and intercepts the missile in space, and basically sacrifices himself for his friend. And his friend's family and people who 5 minutes ago all wanted to kill him.
Right.
And it's a very, I actually think it's an incredibly touching scene.
I do too. That was my favorite thing about the movie, was the fact that it had that beat, that it does the Superman callback and like,
yeah,
it's all great. Especially what you just said, that all these people were afraid of him. They wanted him gone. And yet he's still willing to sacrifice himself for humanity. Cause that's all great, you know, superhero stories or whatever. It's like, you people fear me, you don't understand me, but I'm still looking out for you guys.
Right.
What's
your issue?
I just feel like it undermines it 2 seconds later when it's like, but he's still fine.
How does it not do that, though? How do you make it? My point, and I realize it's been done. There's obviously movies with sad endings.
Yeah.
But I think that this movie, in terms of its scope... Because I do feel like, even though there's some bigger issues at play in terms of paranoia and the Cold War, and
which is another thing I kind of had a problem with,
living, reconciling humanity with this robot who has more soul than humans do, blah blah blah. I do think it's still, at the end of the day, is a pretty small story, and I mean that like it's a simple story. It's about a boy and his pet,
right?
And I think that you can't.
It's like Mac and Me.
You can't kill E.T. You got to bring him back. I think that's even what the writer said to an interviewer. Yeah. Like, you can't. You spend the whole movie loving this character, and I think that it's not. I don't feel it's a disingenuous ending, because I know we've talked on the podcast before about endings that are like they end in such a way that's great, and all of a sudden they have a tag that fucks everything
yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not quite the same thing, but I know the remake of Dawn of the Dead does that.
Yeah.
I even feel like Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof does it a little bit. How yeah, yeah, it ends yeah. and then it yeah. cuts to.
Right.
Them killing Stuntshow Mike. What?
Stuntshow Mike. Sideshow Mike.
Sideshow Mike? What? Stuntman Mike. Jesus.
Who's Stuntman Mike?
Stuntman, what's his name?
Who's Stuntman Mike?
He's a stuntman. Sorry. But I feel like it's a kid, at the end of the day, and I think to address your earlier question, is this movie for
right.
people our age? Is it for adults? Is it for families? Or is it for kids? I think at the end of the day, even though it works entirely for people like me or people like you, that this is obviously geared, it's made by an adult man who has the same sensibilities, it's still a kid's movie. And I think that it would be really hard, I think, for kids, if you're under a certain age, to kind of witness that and say, like, and to be like, but he sacrificed himself for the greater good.
Right.
And aren't we all better off? I mean, yes, there is a
little... How is it that much different than E.T. going home? At the end of E.T.
Because it's
I understand
the knowledge of he's alive.
Dead, but that's, so it, that's really
that's it. Because he doesn't go back to the boy.
Right.
It's he's going the iceberg and
right.
or the what it's in, a it's the glacier in Finland or Iceland is the same as him going to outer space for all intents and purposes until a potential sequel, which thankfully never came.
Right.
But it might as well be outer space. It might as well be the moon, you know?
Right.
I feel like it's fine. I don't know. I don't have an issue with that.
I mean, it's fine the way it's handled, and it's not like it's a deal breaker for me for the movie.
They also telegraph it, though, because earlier in the...
No, I know he's able to sort of rebuild or regenerate or whatever. I don't know. I just feel like it undermines the moment that came before. I'm not saying they shouldn't have done it. I'm just saying it's equivalent to Star Trek III coming after Star Trek II. Like, the end of Star Trek II is very emotional because Spock dies, and it's like, holy shit.
Spoilers!
And then it's immediately undermined, A, by the little coda, and the fact that in Star Trek III, he's totally alive. So it makes the sacrifice sort of meaningless, if that makes sense.
I don't know if I agree with that at all.
Yeah.
Because I really do think that at the time, it's not like... It would be different, I think, if the Iron Giant or if Spock knew that there's a way to regenerate.
Okay.
And there is maybe and we're getting too into like the sentience, this sentientness of Iron Giant, but he sacrifices himself wholly.
No, I know I'm not saying his sacrifice, he doesn't know that he's going to come back. I'm not saying that his sacrifice is meaningless because he's like, this is fine because I'll just fucking regenerate and I'll be fine. I'm just saying like...
But I think that would be disingenuous. And when he in the scene where he closes his eyes
and
embraces and the screen gets lighter, it's like, holy shit, you know, like... I'm as a 30-something, as a 49-year-old man, I still get emotional watching that scene, and it makes me happy as on a visceral level. I get emotional watching that scene, and I've seen the movie like 5 times. I know he's going to come back to life, but on a visceral level, I get sad, and then I get happy, and I feel good when the movie ends. And I think that to be sad and to deal with it as an audience member, and again, I'm an educated man, like I've seen a lot of movies, and I know the score, but watching the parts roll to him in a cartoon. And again, I think the difference is, and I know Brad Bird might be the first person to disagree with me because he's the person who always says it's animation is not a genre. It's an art form. It's, he could say, you know, Brad Bird, if you don't know, is an animation god. He got his start in The Simpsons. I think he worked for
he did Family Dog. Amazing Stories.
Right, right. So obviously like Spielberg pre-Simpsons, and stuff. Yeah. Right. But he got his, like, I guess his break on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And worked for the animation company that the Fox Tracy Ullman show hired, and directed episodes, and then went on to bigger and better things. He's awesome, and he's a huge proponent of animation as an art form, and saying you could have drama, you could have anything be animated. It doesn't have to be kids' fare. So by me saying this,
but
I might
at the same
be,
time, he's sort of only done kids' fare, and it's
but
more,
no, I think just to
no, I think it's I think they're. They're very much kids' movies. I think they have some adult messages in them.
Okay.
But I think he's really only made kids' movies.
With his animation, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. Not Mission Impossible, obviously.
I don't know. I mean,
part of that may just be because
think about
of
a movie like G-Force with the gerbils.
Obviously, no, he's not doing that. He's making the best possible version of kids'
movies.
The
Squeakquel.
And honestly, maybe it's just that his back is up against the wall. Maybe I would assume the only animated movie you could get financed is a kids movie. You know what I mean?
Well, but that's like, I think that's just it too. Like, what do you want it to be? Heavy Metal? You know, like where it's an anime?
No, animated. And I'm
asking like what adult?
Right.
And I'm not trying to be.
But to Brad Bird's point, he's saying it doesn't have to be kids movies. But at the same time, that's all he's made.
Right. What other movies, in all seriousness, have come out that have been like what animated movies?
Oh no, there are hardly any.
I want to know. Right. Like, I'm just like,
well, like Persepolis, okay, Triplets of Belleville.
I mean, guess a lot of the shorts for the Oscar stuff. Those are typically
right, and these are foreign films. You know, right. That American animated movies. Yeah, they're basically just kids movies.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. And I think to what you said before, it's for kids, and I do think it's this small little package of a movie. But I watch it, and I'm. My heart is touched by his sacrifice, and then I'm happier knowing that he survived.
Okay.
And that's maybe just me trying not to be jaded or, you know, not to say that you are or anything, even though you
let's not kid around.
So you'd prefer that the Iron Giant die in front of children? Is that what you're telling me?
It's not that I would necessarily...
Let me go tell you some stories.
It's not that I would necessarily prefer it. I just feel like the moment where he sacrifices himself is earned, and it's very honest, and I was very moved by it because the movie had built to that point, honestly. And then we get the little tag afterwards where I thought of JB because he has this theory about Deus Ex Monstera, where all of life's problems are solved by the interference of a monster. And not that the Iron Giant is a monster, but he's this big robot who gets the mom a new boyfriend, and the kid now has friends at school, and, right. you know, the town is a happier place, all because they have sort of rallied around the Iron Giant. And I think all that still works, even though it's a little pat, you know, that, like, look, Hogarth has friends now. And
speaking of little pat, I'm staring at your pants right now.
But all that stuff still works, and I think it still leaves us happy going out of the movie theater without the tag that, like, and he's still alive, everyone. Again, I don't have a problem with it. It's not like, oh, that ruined the movie for me. I just think, to me, it
right.
Well, I feel like a little bit cheated about the way that I felt when he makes his sacrifice.
I think it does come down, obviously this is all very subjective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've never not said that. But I think, to your point, you, having seen thousands and thousands and thousands of movies.
Most of them starring Steven Seagal.
most of them called JCVD, which I first thought was about venereal disease. that you are okay with that ending. I think if you're introducing people to animation or introducing these themes, even the foreignness of the movie being taking place in the post-Sputnik 1957 Cold War frozen America, mm-hmm. that then to do that, it's like all of a sudden you're making a political, you know, it just becomes more like a heavy. I guess that's the big, it becomes very heavy if that's it. And I think a lot of people, myself included, watched it. And I know that you're saying, I understand what you're saying, but I still think it doesn't take away from the movie. In fact, I think it makes it happier for me.
I guess. I feel like I got yanked around. Like, when I think back to 3 minutes ago when I was, like, kind of choked up at the robot sacrifice, I'm like, oh, I didn't have to feel that way.
But that's a crazy thought, though. You're getting choked. Because you're getting choked up at the sacrifice, but you feel then yanked around because he's not dead? It's like, you'd be unhappy if a grandparent came back from the dead. Like, I would,
because they would want to eat my brains.
I can't believe I watched my parent die in that car crash, but they didn't really die. That's they showed up
not
later.
At all
but
the it, same thing.
It is kind of, though, because no, you're saying, not. Like, I felt this emotional connection to his sacrifice.
Right.
And that he is dead and he is gone and I am. We're all better off because of his existence. And now, because he's still alive, that's bad.
I didn't say it was bad. I said it was slightly dishonest. And I think his sacrifice works. I think narratively it works better if he's gone. And I know that's horrible because kids don't understand why is the robot gone, and I can't explain to my son, like, listen, son, he fulfilled his purpose.
Right.
He was built for a purpose.
But you're also
and
projecting.
He fulfilled that purpose. In fact, he went beyond his purpose because rather than being an instrument of destruction, he used his abilities to ensure peace. And right. So that's a huge deal. Like, I can't explain all that to
but
him.
But you're projecting.
But I can say, like, don't worry, son, he's still okay.
But you're projecting this kind of fantasy future installment of the movie where he comes back. And I think that that's not even necessarily implied. I think if it was that case, he wouldn't have landed in Iceland.
Right.
I think he would have landed in a forest in Maine.
Right.
And would have, like, shown up and popped his head up at the picnic, you know? And right. I think that him being in this, like, desolate, icy region, it's years until they even, until they can reconnect, if they reconnect at all. I don't know. I feel like, I can't imagine being upset with him living.
I think that's mischaracterizing what I'm saying a little bit.
Even in the earlier part, like, we know he can reconstruct. So even, like, his thing, I mean,
upset that he's alive.
I would accept your argument if you said to me, why would he sacrifice himself? Even though it's such a great thematic moment where he is Superman and he embraces his death.
I'm not a monster. I'm a good guy.
Right. But I would almost understand more if you said to me right now, I don't understand why I didn't use those awesome weapons to blow up the missile.
And let's back up a little bit because obviously we could just go back and forth on this ending to the end of the show. I liked the movie. If I have an issue, it's not even honestly with that ending. I'm fine with Dakota. We just spent a long time talking about it, but that's not the big issue. A bigger issue that I have with the movie is the character, and I don't know his name. He's the guy who's hanging around town the whole time trying to find out about the existence of the Iron Giant. He's voiced by Shooter McGavin.
Right.
Do you remember his name by any chance?
Measley?
Okay.
Mansley.
He's an army guy.
He's a civilian. He's not in the army. Okay. He's like a spook. He's a CIA guy. Right.
I just think where his character goes in that last scene is...
It's a little cartoonish. All jokes aside.
Right. It's like we need to get to this point, and so it just doesn't... That didn't work for me. And that's fine, because, it does. It gets us to the point where the missile is coming and he has to... But, like, it's out of control, like, that he's still like, no, just blow him up, shoot him, for no reason. He's staging something, that the kid is dead, and then he's like, no, just shoot him. He tries to get away in a car. The car crashes. It just becomes kind of slapsticky. It's like, no. Everyone's facing their imminent destruction. Like, we don't need the little slapstick beat here.
I think that...
I'm nitpicking a movie. No. I really am.
And I realize why you are, because the movie is awesome. Mm-hmm. And I think we can both agree that the movie does a lot of great things. It's Brad Bird, who is awesome himself. The movie really works. There's so much about that is sweet and touching and has a message and says some great things, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit. The ending, I don't have a problem with that even. The only thing I kind of have a problem with is when... Well, let me back up. The movie has no clear-cut hero or villain, even though obviously the Iron Giant kind of takes on the role of the hero near the end.
Right.
And the villain near the end obviously becomes Mansley.
Right.
But the movie, and I read some critique where they talk... I think Brad Bird and the writer had talked about... This movie was kind of uncharacteristic because there wasn't like the in Ratatouille. There's the short little chef that wants to make sure that Linguini doesn't cook, or there's always like and Brad Bird was saying no, the villain in this movie is paranoia,
right?
And that should be enough. But of course, test audiences or the executives were like, what paranoia? So I think that was even probably heightened a little bit to kind of offset that, or maybe.
And I almost feel like it's not dispersed at all through the other characters. Like, I don't get a huge sense of paranoia from everybody else. So it's like, okay, I have to put it all into this one character.
Right.
And he doesn't even seem paranoid, because even after he finds out the truth, he's not acting out of fear. It's just like, I demand to be right.
I think the movie's walking a tightrope, though, because a lot of people could look at this movie as being a peacenik, PC, liberal, guns are not the answer. Peace is the answer. I think a lot of people that are jaded, and I mean that, like, and I'll be honest, like, I'm probably left of center, and I respond to this movie in lots of ways, lots of different ways. But I think if you're taking the tact of the other person, the right-wing person, the person who is pro-military, pro-gun, you're saying, well, a gun has one purpose, and that's to shoot. And the movie's saying, no, you choose what you want to be, and that's whatever. The movie walks a tightrope because... It doesn't demonize the army.
Right.
And I think that it's so easy to do that. It would be so easy to kind of take this big group, especially Cold War American Army, pre-Vietnam, post-World War II Russian enemies group, and say, they're the enemy. That's taking a couple steps too far. And I kind of like that it humanizes the general character voiced by John
Mahoney.
Frasier's dad. He's sensible.
I liked the dog.
He's sensible, and he's relatable, and he shows human. He's making decisions, and he's the one. And you can't really obviously pick out individual soldiers and say that they're going to be whatever. This Mansley character, I think it does build. I think you're right. At the end, it does ramp up a great deal. And my only issue, and this is what I'll go back to, or this is what I'm coming back to, is that I don't have a problem with him grabbing the microphone or the walkie-talkie and telling the Nautilus to launch the missile. I do have a problem with the coda of that little scene where the general explains to him that, you idiot, you just launched a missile. It's targeted on the giant. The giant's 2 feet from you.
Right.
And he says, this is it. We're all going to die. But by the way, a little side note, part of that scene I love in that they're so like resigned to like, we just fucked up and we're all going to die.
Right.
And I do love that, because you rarely see that where there's like a weird acceptance of, it's a little bit in Toy Story 3.
Right?
But then Mansley has to go the step further, which is, this is what I have the biggest problem with, where the general says like, you just launched a nuke over America. You're going to kill us all. And he says, screw America. I want to live.
Right.
And that to me is so like ham-fisted and heavy-handed.
Right.
Both of those two cliches, and and that's when it becomes, because he says like, basically, F my country, everything he's fought for, and he gets in the car and drives, and the Iron Giant stops him, and then does this little, like, fists on his hip thing, and it becomes a little over the top
at that point. He should have picked him up, and then carried him over a little bit, and ripped the top off of the jailhouse, and dropped him in.
He should have, I think Mansley at that point should have morphed into a sucker, and then had sucker emblazoned across his forehead. So my point simply is, I think that it's difficult to not demonize the army when you're making those kind of overtures. So to put it on this one guy who's not military, he's civilian, but he is CIA, so it kind of, you know, carries the same weight. But also, I do have a problem with this, like, screw America, I want to live, and he drives away. Right. But I think all the other stuff is natural, and I think it does come from a genuine place. Maybe not genuine in the universe of the movie, but a genuine place if you really think back to 1950s America with this crazy... Let me pause right there and say, I think the movie is interesting because the 50s, and you could probably talk about this more because you love stuff from the 50s, even genuine real stuff from the 50s, but also kind of like throwbacks. Set in the 50s. Yeah, like matinee and whatever, and even Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Where the 50s, even today, people have this fantasized notion about what the 50s are. It's the perfect era.
Right.
Music was clean. It was black and white. It's Pleasantville, basically, where it's like everything is perfect. Everyone knew their place, which is such veiled, you know, language for, you know, discrimination, racism, whatever, sexism. But underneath, there's a current of paranoia and just crazed fear.
Right.
And I think that
we can
movie
all die at any time.
The movie does that, a really interesting balancing act with that too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, Roger Ebert has this big complaint about Die Hard, that the Paul Gleason character exists only to be wrong every step of the way. And I just...
Which
I
character is Paul Gleason? I'm sorry.
He's the...
Dad
the
from
police.
Family Matters?
No. His boss.
Okay.
And I got a little bit of that from this Mansley character that just, like, everything that's wrong sort of gets dumped into this one character who becomes kind of a stooge. And I just felt like so much of the movie gave us more credit than that as an audience, that to have this one character who's sort of broad. Like you said, I mean, the general is such an interesting sort of fleshed out character that we're not used to seeing in any movie, much less an animated children's film.
Right.
That it takes the Mansley character really far, you know, but whatever, again, none of these things are,
in a way, I think that might be, and I see your point, because it would be, you know, there would be more weight to it if it wasn't just one crazy rogue character that is kind of like representing all of that paranoia.
Right.
But I think it's shown a little bit with the townspeople with, like, I saw a giant robot and blah, blah, blah. And he's watching, you know, I think he has like a Forbidden Planet poster on as well. All this like kind of stuff.
Right.
But I think it's also maybe easier, and this is not doesn't make it good, I'm just saying it's easier at the end of the movie to kind of put all that on one person so we can easily discard this crazy and say we're, as a country, we're still great.
Right. I mean, is the movie any worse if the military does order the missile launch and then discovers that they're wrong when he sacrifices himself? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I don't know. Maybe there's not a good way to make that work. There's this little thing that the movie does to get away from the ending. That I love, and I was trying to think of where else have I seen that, and I'm pretty sure it's Toy Story 2. In Toy Story 2, there's the great scene where Woody is watching an old episode of Woody's Roundup, and it's like black and white, bad marionette, like,
you know?
And it's funny because it's like, that's how you show that it's sort of old and things have gotten better, like, you know, the technology or TV or whatever. And this movie does kind of the same thing when Hogarth is watching that, like, duck and cover movie in school, that the animation is real crude and, like, but you're watching bad animation inside of good animation in order to make the distinction between, like, this is old and cheap and this is real. It's fascinating.
Absolutely.
And you don't even think about, you know, it plays that game and you don't even necessarily think about it until you step back and say, like, but these are both cartoons that I'm watching.
Right.
It's just...
And it's a totally different style. It's totally And I think it's funny too because it's obviously based on the duck and cover movie, and it is very on the nose about, like, you know, hide under your desk, and it shows the crater surrounding the desk. And I want to say that the title is called something like Nuclear Annihilation, which is just hilarious to me too. That it's not called Duck and Cover or We'll All Be Safe. It's called Nuclear or Atomic Annihilation or something like that.
The movie definitely had me in the first couple minutes when Hogarth's mom has to work late, who's voiced by Jennifer Aniston, like, who I didn't hate, and, you know, right. I have...
She actually does a...
Yeah.
Good job. It's not too showy. It doesn't draw attention to herself. It's
kind of a weird choice, but whatever. Right. It works. She says, don't stay up late, you know, don't watch movies. And it cuts to him, like, in a dark room, eating popcorn, watching some bad old science fiction movie. Right. I'm like, oh, well, the movie has me.
From I thought point, that, yeah, know? When I watched, when I rewatched it last night, and I watched that one scene, I thought to myself, there's Mant.
Yeah, exactly. Right,
from
right.
Matinee, the fake movie in Matinee. It's definitely in him like, I forgot my keys.
And there's a lot of similarities between Iron Giant and Matinee, you know, partially because of the main character, partially just because of the time period and sort of what they're dealing with, that they're taking these ideas about science fiction and popular culture and sort of filtering them through the, like, Cold War America.
Right.
Everybody's afraid, and here's how we... You know, we dealt with some of these fears through our popular culture, but what happens when the chickens come home to roost, as Malcolm X would say?
I see what you did there. Yeah. I absolutely
I quoted know. Brother Malcolm. Do you think that we will ever see a return to traditional cell animation?
I do not think
so. I don't
either. I think, like we talked about...
Even watching this, I was like, this feels dated.
It's interesting.
Even though it's great animation, and I really like cell animation.
I do, too, and you watch... Although, I will say, have you watched Aladdin recently? Or have you put on...
No.
...a Disney film? Can't say that I have. The other day, and this might actually was a couple...
I saw the first half of The Lion King when it was re-released a few months ago.
The first half?
Yeah, I took my son, and...
He zoned out.
He was done, so we left. Yeah.
How did it look?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. My point simply is this. I was watching, I don't know if it was like the Disney Channel or some movie channel was playing Aladdin a couple months ago on cable.
I think it was the Family Channel.
Yeah, okay. So I was watching TV and Aladdin came on.
Yeah.
And I remember as a kid, I'm like, this is great. This is the 90s, my Disney era with Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and et cetera. Hunchback of, no, I'm kidding. what was it? Little Mermaid? What else is there?
Mulan. Ugh. The Emperor's New Groove.
And I was kind of taken aback. And not to say, like, I'm some sort of CGI purist or, like, how... And CGI obviously looks awesome. You know, you can't argue that. But there is still some charming stuff about when you watch an old Disney stuff, it works. It still plays. Aladdin, it didn't to me. It felt very kind of choppy and odd. But maybe that's just me. I don't think it's coming back. I think we talked earlier about Winnie the Pooh being a novelty. And I think that you always will see it because there always will be, like, the Persepolis or, like, the types of movies that are very self-contained novelties. But I think, and it's kind of a shame too, because you can't just be a good artist to be a filmmaker. You know, Disney was a great artist and actually was a better, good head for talent and finding other artists and a businessman above all else. But he, at the end of the day, it was just about like repetition and drawing and honing your skill. You have to be a great artist and a mathematician to be a CGI cartoonist, because unless they make the software even more and more advanced, and I think it might get to a point in 20 years where literally it's gonna you're gonna press a button that says animate on your computer, and all of a sudden it's gonna take, you know, like whatever, and just turn it into a cartoon. Yeah. So I don't see that happening.
I don't think it'll ever like come back all the way. I just wonder if it can ever coexist, and I don't think so. Unfortunately,
I don't think so either. I think,
and it's just upsetting because look at all these expensive CGI cartoons that come out every year, and there's more and more of them every year now because they all make so much goddamn money. Whatever, whatchamacallit just made the Lorax just made $70 million its opening weekend, right?
Because of Dr. Seuss's birthday.
But like, Iron Giant made $5 million. Is that what you said? Like,
yeah, just over $5 million, I think.
I mean, look at and that's $70 million in one weekend.
And it's still interesting too because the movie, like I mentioned before, does incorporate some early CGI techniques. Mm-hmm. The giant. You could tell when the car... You know, it's kind of funny when I watch Futurama, which I don't actually watch often, but it's on Comedy Central sometimes, and it used to be on before or after The Simpsons. And The Simpsons is still... actually, that might be the place where cell animation exists, is cartoons on TV shows. The Simpsons, obviously, is still a drawn show, with maybe occasionally some CGI, like the movie had some. But I remember when Futurama came out, it did the same thing, a lot of the same things as Iron Giant did. Like, it would show scope and perspective and show cars move and spaceships move that is so smooth and slick that it has to be CGI. So it just was like kind of cheating a little bit, you know, but I don't think that we'll see that.
I did really like the fact too that Brad Bird chose to shoot or not shoot, but you know, make the Iron Giant in that super wide, like, CinemaScope format. Yeah. And I read, like, that was because that was the way that the sci-fi movies of the time were made. And I just, you know, you have to appreciate guys like that who are working, you know, in animation, making a children's film with that kind of attention to detail right. that, you know, kids don't care about, but, like, we do, you know?
It's just a testament to Brad Bird's kind of attention to detail and his, you know, just insane focus yeah. about, like, all the, everything has to be perfect. A question for you, do you have any issue, having seen the movie a bunch of times, and maybe, obviously, you've seen it once now, and I think you'll come back to it.
I definitely will, yeah. I'm still just kind of reacting to things, unfortunately, so
right.
And you sound stupid on this podcast. I apologize.
You sound stupid. but handsome.
Stupid. Thank you.
You sound stupidly handsome. Do you find that some of the themes, some of the messages,
yeah.
and there's a couple like, does a gun have a soul?
Right.
Or are you what you choose to be?
Right.
Or guns, I think Hogarth said something about how killing is bad, but dying isn't bad.
Right.
Do you find any of these overly simplistic, or that the fact that they come from a boy to a robot, and the robot is, you know, like, they're the adults teaching us, like, the adults' lessons, basically. Do you find any of that to be contradictory, or you have issues?
I don't know, because honestly, I was so reacting to the fact that some of these messages were even in, basically, a children's film.
Yeah.
Killing is bad, but dying isn't bad. I mean, that's, like, holy shit.
Because I think he follows up with, like, someday you'll die.
Right.
And he's like, yeah.
Oh, my God. They're right. saying this in a cartoon.
Right.
So I think I was reacting to that. I don't necessarily think it's overly simplified. I don't.
What about the thing where, I think in that same sequence where they watch the deer die from yeah. the hunters and yeah. he reacts to the guns and the guns are bad and blah, right. blah, blah. He talks about how when you die, or he says, well, you, Iron John asks, will I die? And he says, well, I don't know. You're made of metal, but you have feelings and you have a soul
mm-hmm.
and souls don't die. Does that feel religious to you at all? Do you feel like there's a kind of overriding religious arc?
Maybe. I mean, honestly, I didn't react to that very much. Like, I didn't really think about it because to me, the way that I interpreted that moment, and again, I just saw a movie, was just as that it was a way of sort of justifying the fact that the robot made moral choices or, you sure. know, like, how do we explain he's a robot or he's an alien or who knows what he is?
It's interesting that it seems the subject matter and the dialogue specifically is yeah. very emotional and sensitive and draws from the human experience,
mm-hmm.
but you're noticing it purely as like a function of the movie.
Right.
Showing like, it's almost like on page 83, we have to talk about the soul so that on page 86, the robot can do this.
Right. And maybe these other readings would come with subsequent viewings of the movie. I don't know. But that was my initial reaction to that.
Scene. Last question I have.
All right.
Were you blown away by Vin Diesel's performance as the Iron Giant and his 53 words?
Yeah, he was good. I mean, I read, again, I'm sure we read the same, like, Wikipedia bullshit or whatever, but, like, they were going to get Peter Cullen,
yeah.
who did the voice of Optimus Prime, which I think would have been a mistake, honestly, because he's so associated with...
Right.
Optimus Prime.
They were also talking about getting James Earl Jones.
No, that's a mistake too.
And another big name.
You can't go with like these Morgan iconic voice actors. No, it's
like,
actors,
yeah, yeah,
know?
they're like, doing that. And even what I actually like, and I'm not a big Vin. I don't really care.
Have
one
you
way
seen
or
Triple
other.
X? The things I'm gonna do for my country.
I don't really care about Vin Diesel. I honestly don't. Like, I don't. He's,
Riddick.
He can have a job. He cannot
You're
have a job.
You're being ridiculous.
I wish him the best. But I remember when, like, Vin Diesel, why does he get, like, a title card above the kid who plays Hogarth, you know? Because he has 53 words. But I actually think, and I'm sure that there's some manipulation with the sound effects and
yeah.
whatever, that the performance, the vocal performance, if you can call it that, is actually pretty great.
Yeah.
You know? And I was, like, watching it this most recent time, I'm like, wow, I think I always made fun of that before, but I don't know how it would be better from with anyone else.
It's effective, and it's very much its own thing, unlike casting James Earl Jones, where it's like, oh, you got the guy from Darth Vader to do right. this, or Optimus Prime, or whatever. Like, this voice is very much associated with this character and will be forever, right. you know? And that, I think, was a smart thing to do.
Do you have a problem with the Iron Giant living his life a quarter mile at a time?
I do not.
Running
I do
ain't
not.
Freedom. And flying into a missile ain't freedom also, is my point. Well, I'm glad you finally saw it. I've been
yeah,
kind
me
of
too.
Pushing you. It's one of the few things I feel like I've seen that you haven't, but I knew you would like it.
It's the weirdest because I've always wanted to, and I just never have. And it's been on my shelf for years, and I've like always have an excuse.
Good thing we have a podcast.
I know.
So we have this excuse to watch.
Damn good thing. Damn good.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah,
I still love it. I could watch it again. It speaks to me also as Brad Bird's first movie. It feels like that, almost like a Reservoir Dogs to Quentin Tarantino's canon, where this is like his simple hand-drawn animation. Right. He moves on to Incredibles, which I love a little more than Ratatouille, but Ratatouille seems to be a step above Incredibles.
Yeah, but Ratatouille to me feels a little bit removed from Brad Bird, only because it wasn't his movie. You know, he stepped in after they had the original director of Ratatouille. And he did a great job. But
yeah, but there's so much about that seems like him, though, in that movie.
Yeah, and maybe he did a rewrite or ask for things to change. I don't know. It doesn't feel to me as much to come straight out of Brad Bird the way that like The Incredibles to me.
Well, The Incredibles also
really does,
has a lot of the same things as Iron Giant in that it's a love of the 50s, that sort of era of superheroes.
Era. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com and make sure to go into iTunes and give us a happy rating if you like it.
A happy ending, if you will.
Thank you, Douglas. Do you want to take us out?
Superman.